Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Connolly, and Judge Cochran, Judge Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the third of three cases scheduled for oral argument this November 17th, 2021. We are proceeding by Zoom today, obviously, but the rules apply just as if we were in the courtroom. Appellants will have a combined 15 minutes to present their argument in chief. Respondents will have a combined 15 minutes for responsive argument, followed by 5 minutes in rebuttal. It's important that you all state your names and identify the parties you represent when you begin your arguments. And I understand that counsel for the appellants will be splitting their initial time equally. Is that correct? All right, I see nodding from Ms. Lynn. So that would be 7.5 minutes apiece. I understand, Ms. Lynn, that you will present argument first. My question is whether you intend to also split the 5 minute rebuttal period.
Truthfully, I'm not 100% sure. I think that would have to be, I think I would go first in rebuttal, and then it would depend on what else happens during the respondents' periods, Your Honor.
Well, at this point, we'll plan on splitting the rebuttal time equally, and I will intend to call on you, Ms. Lynn, first in rebuttal, and if you exceed 2.5 minutes, that would take away time from any time that Mr. Kluver would have available to him, so I'll let you make that assessment. So if I'll ask the marshal to set the clock, I don't know if it's possible to set it to 7.5 minutes. That would be a good way to proceed. And just be mindful, Ms. Lynn, that if you exceed 7.5 minutes, you will be taking time away from the other appellant. Let's just see if we can do that. Otherwise, all right, it looks like we are ready to go. And so Ms. Lynn, you may proceed with your argument.
Good morning, Your Honor. If it may please the court, my name is Crystal Linning. I represent the appellant JDM, the father in this case, or the one of the fathers in this case. The other father voluntarily terminated his parental rights. Today we are here on really the most important issue that really can ever come, in my opinion, in front of a court, and that is the issue of parental rights and termination of those parental rights. And I say it's the most important issue because so frequently what I've seen and what we even see in this case is some notion that termination of parental rights, the protections are less than, they're not as important, that, hey, I mean, we get a lower standard of proof, we get a lower evidentiary setting. And I want to disavow that to start, because that is one of the arguments that seems to be coming on here, is that, well, this is termination, we don't have the same level. And my point is that there is really no right more important in this country, in this world, than a parent's right to parent their child. That connection is really the most important thing. If you talk to a parent's going to say, would you die for your child? Without hesitation. Would you go to prison to say, if you somebody tells you you can never see your child again, or would you go to prison for 5 years? They're going to choose prison. So when we start off by thinking, well, lesser standards, not as important, we are going to make it easier to terminate parental rights.
Well, I mean, Ms. Linne, it's clear and convincing, correct?
It is indeed, Your Honor. It's clear and convincing, but the evidence—
So it's higher than a preponderance of the evidence, not as much as beyond a reasonable doubt. And I certainly agree with you. I think both Judge Bjorkman, Judge Cochran, and I would agree there is nothing more important than these cases. I had one question regarding your client. I know he never admitted to the allegations. Did he ever specifically deny them at any point?
He did, yes. In fact,
at the trial?
Yes, at end trial, he testified and he specifically denied that it ever happened.
Thank you.
And
relatedly, counsel, in your brief, you argue that the district court erred by admitting the forensic interviews. And I believe you cite to Minnesota Statute 595.05 subdivision 3 and the 2012 version. After reviewing respondent's brief, would you agree that the analysis should be reviewed under that issue should be reviewed with regard to Minnesota Statute 260C.165. Isn't that the relevant statute?
Yes and no, Your Honor. I did actually specifically address that in my reply brief, being that, you know, it's one, it's are there conflicting statutes? And you go into that whole thing is what's more specific? Are they, do they truly conflict? And I would say in these cases, it's one of the arguments is that, well, does it create kind of what they say an absurd result? And that kind of goes into my first point is that this is very important. So at what point do we say in any other case, you need corroborating evidence or that child has to be unavailable to testify and that child has to be unavailable to testify or that child should testify. And so the question is at what point in this case where it is incredibly important, should we say, no, we're going to make it easier. We're going to create the evidentiary standard significantly less than any other case.
And but, so well, I would say counsel, to be fair, it's the legislature that has created the standard that applies in a child protection case. I mean, aren't we obligated to follow 260C.165 as was the district court?
No, I don't think you are. And I kind of go into that one because I don't really think they truly conflict because you can still say, again, you go through the standards and one, I would have to say, because they mirror. So the case law that actually applies the two different standards can apply in both cases because the case law doesn't specifically go into the whole, well, the child needs to testify, but all the things you need to know about it is, well, you need to determine reliability and how do you determine reliability of these out of court statements? And that's by having these two evidence by either corroborating evidence or the child testifies. And so I really don't think they truly conflict too terribly much, Your Honor, because I think the standard is still there for courts is they can look at that and say, well, if the reliability isn't there, we shouldn't be admitting that. And I think in this case, very specifically, if you look at the reliability of those statements and the actions that happen afterwards, as they say, you look into, are there leading questions? Are there corroborating factors? Has the testimony been reaffirmed or the statements been reaffirmed? What's the reliability of the witnesses? And you go in these cases where, like in child one, for instance, the child has never reaffirmed that she's never restated. And in fact, when we specifically asked her, her therapist, like the therapist admitted, nope, she's never restated these allegations to me. Then you go in further as to the actions of the child afterwards, where she talks about, oh, well, yeah, I've admitted that I've made up me wanting to commit suicide to get attention. I've admitted that I've lied about my mom hitting me if I thought she was, because I wanted to get her in trouble because I thought she wasn't paying enough attention to me. So again, when you go into the two statutes, I don't think they're really opposed. The same standard is there. They need to be reliable. And so in these cases, because you look at all of these, I don't think they're reliable. They are definitely not very probative when you look at the other statements. And so they shouldn't have been admitted and they shouldn't have been relied on by the district court, particularly the statement with child two. Because again, you go back into those factors. It's like, what happened here? In the second interview, all of a sudden child two completely changed several months later, which should be a huge red flag, as now all of a sudden she was remembering things she couldn't even possibly remember, which tells me somebody is coaching child two to say these things. And especially if you look at the leading nature.
Did you make these arguments, I presume, in closing to the district court?
I believe I made them during these arguments, not in possibly in closing. Yes, they would have been made in closing. They also would have been made during the trial as well, Your Honor, when I objected to the admission of these two statements.
Thank you.
Counsel, what is your strongest argument for reversal?
I think the strongest argument for reversal is the facts or the statement of the order is not supported by the facts, Your Honor. But beyond that, even when it comes to reasonable services, the one thing I really want to address is that the county has to do three things when creating a case plan. They have to prepare it jointly with the parent. It has to be explained to the parent. It has to be signed by the parent. None of that happened in this case with my client. They fully admitted the first time anybody sat down and reviewed this case plan with my client was March 9th of 2021, which was 2 months after the petition was for termination had been filed and less than a month before trial. And so when, again, that goes into the whole issues about the standards and whether or not reasonable efforts failed and whether or not he neglected to comply with his duties, that all goes back to the case plan. Did he comply with it? Well, in this case, you have a county who did not follow any of the restrictions they're supposed to file. And so I think that alone is a huge red flag about why the services in this case were not reasonable.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kluver, you may proceed on behalf of the other appellant. And you are muted still.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Douglas Kluver. I represent the mother ALR in this matter. The courts have made it clear that it's an abuse of discretion for the court to make a determination regarding termination of parental rights based on past history rather than the conditions at the time of the hearing. And in our case, that is exactly what happened. The county's basis for a termination was that the mother was palpably unfit. And the specific reasons for that was, number one, the mother's alcohol use. However, at the time of termination, the mother's alcohol use was under control. Although she did have a slip just before, she had been to her assessor, who did not recommend any further treatment. And she just didn't have these issues that such that would affect her parenting. And the law
go ahead, Judge Cochran.
What specific findings are you challenging with regard to mother's alcohol use? When you say it was under control, what findings are you challenging in that regard?
Well, that the mother's drinking impacted her parenting. The law is clear that there has to be a causal relationship established between the mother's alcohol use or the parent's alcohol use and her inability to parent the children. And this is what I'm saying. There was no finding that tied those two together. There was just findings that mother drank when she wasn't supposed to. There was arguments that she missed a test, which I went over in my brief, that isn't exactly what happened. But alcohol, there was simply no finding connecting alcohol use to her inability to parent.
But Mr. Kluver, let me ask you this. If I agree with you that alcohol wasn't a problem, then why does mother continue to use alcohol, including 3 days before the trial, when she's been told very specifically as part of her case plan and in district court orders that she is not to use alcohol?
And I understand that she is not supposed to use alcohol, but she did have it's not to say that she didn't have a problem with alcohol. A lot of people drink alcohol, parent their kids successfully. The question is, does her use of alcohol, is there a causal connection? And that's why the court can't use that issue as a basis to terminate, because there is no causal connection between her ability to parent and her use of alcohol. That's a compliance issue. That's terminating somebody based on compliance, not based on progress.
Did she report her relapses to the child protection authorities? Because I think that might be a strong, did she?
She only had one relapse.
Did she report that?
Since she had her treatment. She reported it to my office immediately. In fact, she tried to do it right away that night. She called and then got a hold of me in the morning. It's in the record that I immediately called Mr. Haugen and informed him to let the county know.
I have to admit, Mr. Kluver, I thought in looking, I mean, I did see the sobriety issues, but I really thought that the main reason for termination in the conclusions of law found on page 19 of the district court's order related to both the physical abuse and then the sort of not taking action regarding Ms. Linnae's clients as to the sexual abuse. Would you agree that those would provide an independent basis for the court's ruling, apart from?
I would agree, Your Honor, if they were an issue in this case. This is a made-up issue in this case. Physical discipline of the children, there was no physical discipline issues during this CHIPS, nor was there any just preceding the chips.
What about child one's hesitation to go home after the, I forget the exact language. I think she says, in paragraph 13 of the findings of fact, that child one further reported, "My mom will beat me if I go home." This is after the forensic interview.
After the forensic interview, which was over a year before the termination, that goes to my point that the judge never looked at this as far as what are the conditions now. The judge looked at anything the court could grab from the past that would substantiate.
Given that the children were removed from the home, I mean, how does the court make that determination then?
I don't know what the court's asking.
I'm sorry. The children were, I'll retract the question. I have to look at the finding of fact I'm trying to think of here.
Let me ask you this. As I understand the record, there were concerns that had come to light before this CHIPS proceeding, concerns about the children getting to school, concerns about potential physical abuse, maltreatment. At the same time, there are concerns about mother's alcohol use. I think what Judge Cochran was referring to is that obviously during the CHIPS proceeding, these children were never returned to mother's home. And so they were not subject to ongoing physical abuse by mother. But to the extent that the alcohol use continued, I guess what would assure the district court and what evidence in the record would lead us to find that that the district court's findings concerning the conditions before the child that were ongoing and continuous are clearly erroneous.
This was not a child abuse case. There was no programming at all in the case plan for any sort of discipline or any sort of programming to help mother that way. It simply wasn't an issue. It's an issue that becomes an issue when, hey, let's terminate mom. Let's go back and grab everything we can. But again, at the time of the trial, there was no issue like that. Same with the failing to protect the children. Mother never said she didn't believe the child. The mother said that she didn't know what to believe and she would keep Mr. McAlpin away if in any event. And I see my time's expired. Thank you.
You will have some amount of time for rebuttal. We will now turn to counsel for the respondents.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Matthew Hogan and I am the Chippewa County attorney. I represent the appellant, the respondent, Chippewa County Family Services, this morning. I have just a few brief comments for the court in response to the arguments made today by the appellants in their brief. I believe most of my arguments are highlighted in my brief, so I don't want to belabor the point. I'd like to begin, and I really see there being two separate issues here. The first issue has been raised by one of the appellant fathers regarding these out-of-court statements. I believe my office and the court is bound by the laws and statutes of the state of Minnesota. The legislature has passed 260C.165. This is the basis under which my office moved the court to admit the forensic interviews of child one and child two into evidence. The requirements are very clearly laid out in that statute, and I'll summarize. One, that the children be under the age of 10 when the statement is made. That was met in both of these instances, that the statement explained sexual penetration or conduct either on that individual making the statement or witnessed by that individual, child one being the victim of the sexual conduct or penetration, child two describing what she witnessed firsthand while peering underneath a door as appellant father sexually assaulted child one. Three, that the time, content, and circumstances of the statement indicate that they are reliable. The court made findings and there was extensive discussions at trial and there was testimony offered about who conducted the interviews, what training they had, what the training was designed to provide for, and really what safeguards are in place to make sure that the forensic interview process is respected and that the outcomes can be trusted by the court. So I do argue that the third and the court agreed that the circumstances indicate that they're reliable, and that the proponent, that being my office, notifies the other party in advance that we intend to offer this. My office, along with counsel for other parties, did have discussions before, and I did put them on notice that I intended to do this. All discovery was provided to the parties before the hearing in advance. So I believe that element was met as well. Ms. Linney,
I just want to confirm, none of Ms. Linney's clients' incarcerations related to, the alleged sexual abuse that took place by him against one of the children. Is that a fair statement?
It is not a fair statement. He was in custody, standing trial or waiting trial for or based on the allegations of child one against him. A trial was held or was a beginning. There was going to be a process whereby which child one would not actually be in the same room as the appellant father. And that when she got on the stand, had difficulty even with the assistant of her counselor in making any statements, and she basically clammed up under the nervousness of the trial. And immediately following that day of trial, he was released and the charges were dismissed.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Your Honor. So getting back to the arguments made by Ms. Linney, she would argue that there's additional requirements that are placed upon my office to be able to offer the interview of child one and child two. And in my review of the statute and the case law, I just don't see that. There is no requirement that there be other corroborating evidence, mm-hmm. that there be physical evidence. And even if there was such
a requirement— Mr. Haugen, I speaking for myself and not the panel, I think we agree with you. The statute says what it says. Could you move on to the issues that Mr. Kluver said relating to at the time of trial, mother's sobriety was, better, and that the court was focused on the past as opposed to the current circumstances of her alcoholism?
I certainly can, Your Honor. I direct the court to page 7 of the amended findings of fact by the court. Finding number 21 indicates on April 6, 2020, Ms. Rogers signed a case plan stating that she understood her sobriety was a requirement for the return of her children. Ms. Rogers relapsed twice at signing the safety plan and failed to notify Chippewa County Family Services. Ms. Rogers did not notify her attorney or did notify her attorney of the relapse. And that's the most recent relapse just before trial. I also would direct the court to the bottom of that page, finding 29. Ms. Rogers testified at trial that she hasn't been the best example for her children and that she hasn't been truthful. Your Honor, I do believe there are certain instances where people can consume alcohol and provide adequate care for their children. I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is under the totality of the circumstances, what's going on in this house and what Ms. Rogers and Mr. McKelvin were suffering from as parents and the deficiencies that they had, it was not capable of them to be consuming alcohol, and it was made clear to them through the case plan. I agree with Ms. Linney that the case plan needs to be developed with the family and to try and address the issues that the county has identified, and also work on to see if there's any other services that the parents maybe can ask for. And I do believe that was provided in this case. I do believe Chippewa County Family Services tried to work with the parties to try to develop a case plan, tried to identify what they believed was the concerns for Mr. McKelpin. It was the concerns related to this alleged sexual assault. One of the requirements that was placed in his case plan was that he complete a psychosexual evaluation. That was not completed. At trial, he testified that he didn't feel something, the effect that he didn't feel it was necessary, and that he was not a chomo or a child molester. Well, that's really what the psychosexual, in my opinion, was trying to address. Is there an issue here? Is there an issue that needs to be addressed? And if there is an issue that needs to be addressed, what are the services that can be provided to him? When that doesn't get
on that point, Mr. Haugen, I don't see, I mean, he was arrested and then the charges were dismissed. And he, according to Ms. Linney, consistently denied it. I don't see it to be such a surprise that he would say, well, I'm not going to do the psychosexual because I didn't do this. So why would I undergo a psychosexual evaluation and any recommended treatment if this never happened? I mean, is that such a surprise?
It's not a surprise, Your Honor, but the county still had concerns. Chippewa County Family Services does believe, my office does believe, that there was a sexual assault. My office would not have brought the charges if we did not believe it. But at the same time, when presented with the evidence at trial that we had, we could not move forward. So I'm not saying that his reluctance to do so was not I don't want to say reasonable, but understandable, but that still doesn't diminish the concern that Chippewa County Family Services had about returning child three to his father's care, or returning child one and child two and child three to mother's care where Mr. McAlpin could be there. What I understand the CHIPS proceeding to be is to make sure not just that we're providing services, but that also the children are safe. And without addressing those issues and just taking the fact that we could not move forward with the criminal matter, to me, is not sufficient, not to say we need to at least investigate to make sure there's no issues.
Mr. Edwin, was there any evidence presented at the trial by anybody that the child subject of the interview had recanted the allegations?
Your Honor, I can't represent to the court that there was not. Ms. Linney and her arguments did make some statements that there were different comments that she had made. I do not recall there ever being any testimony at trial or that I'm aware of outside of trial or any statement by child one where she ever directly said this did not happen or this, I did not make these statements correctly.
Mr. Haugen, I'd like to follow up on questions with respect to the mother. And the argument was made by Mr. Kluver that the alcohol use was unconnected to any of the parenting concerns that precipitated the CHIPS proceeding. What is the evidence that would link mother's alcohol use to the prior physical abuse or other concerns that precipitated the CHIPS petition?
I guess broadly, if the court does look at the evidence provided, for example, there were findings, page 6, of the amended order, review of the video recordings on Ms. Rogers. On November 18th, 2019, Ms. Rogers recorded a video of her interaction with Mr. McAlpin in which she accused him of sexually assaulting child one. You used my 9-year-old to get a nut off and you were touching her and you made her suck you. I would argue that if the court looks at the evidence presented, there were many times throughout the trial where she was under the influence of alcohol. I think when this statement was made or this conversation was made, she was also under the influence of alcohol. And I believe the children, had previously made statements in the forensic interviews that when Mr. McAlpin and Ms. Rogers were together, they were often in her bedroom consuming alcohol and they had seen her bringing beers in there. So I think the alcohol abuse and use does directly go to supervision, her mindset when she's caring for the children, and her propensity to use physical discipline outside the bounds, which I would argue is reasonable, on the children.
Mr. Haugen, can you address the court's best interest analysis and whether it adequately considered the factors that are required to be considered in that analysis?
Yes, Your Honor. I do feel that the factors were considered. I know, I believe both appellants raised the issue that they didn't consider all the factors. I don't believe that is true. The court, during the trial was a 4-day trial. There were, I think, 12 or 13 witnesses, 42 exhibits. The evidence was very extensive in this case. And so I do feel that the court's determination of what is in the children's best interest is sufficient to find that. The court, when speaking about appellant mother, for example, talked about the fact of the concerns the children had about returning home, that the children had concerns that if they did return home, there would be physical abuse. The concerns that mother 3 days before the beginning of the trial was still using alcohol had been seen at Mr. McAlpin's home in Clarkfield, Minnesota, and her lack of truthfulness. So I think the court's findings are sufficient to support the findings that the best interests of the children were met in terminating the parental rights of both appellants. I guess I don't have any more arguments for the court, Your Honor. I could belabor going through each and every specific element of each requirement related to either parent. I'm open to questions, but I would ask the court to affirm the decision of the district court, finding that the findings are sufficient, that they're not erroneous, and that it is in the children's best interest, and that the court did not abuse its discretion in terminating the rights of the two appellants. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now move to rebuttal argument. I think what I will do is ask the marshal to put 5 minutes on the timer. And Ms. Linney, I'll have you start, and just be aware that the more time you take, the less time Mr. Kluver will have out of that 5 minutes. So with that in mind, Ms. Linney, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, the one thing I did want to bring up, and Mr. Kluver can address this as well, is that you were asking questions about mom, and I don't represent mom, but my client's position has always been he wants his son to be returned to his mom. He thinks his mom can care for him. Is that a lot of those also issues about regarding the physical discipline and stuff like that would have been addressed via the case plans. If you look at the testimony regarding the in-home workers and everything like that, that work with mom, they all kind of supported that the children should be returned home. So I think that's the one thing that should be considered. It seems like those were addressed. Those happened far before, and nobody knows even when it happened. There was no testimony regarding when it happened. But as far as this discipline, it seemed like that happened even before they moved to Minnesota, and that all would have been addressed via the case planning with mom. Going back just to very briefly, I don't want to belabor the point too much. I do believe that regardless of which statute is applied here or whether or not the child needs to testify, I don't think that changes the analysis as to when the courts look at whether or not if they're leading questions, corroborating factors, everything like that. In these cases, you have a child two's testimony, for instance. She never specifically said she stated anything. She said she looked under the door and she could see Ja'Cory, but at no point could she see her sister. So it goes into what did child two see? She never actually says she saw anything that happened. And so you have those issues. Regarding, I think you had asked some questions about if child one had recanted. I think the point is we were never really given access to child one or really have her testify or question. What we do know is that throughout the exhibits and her work with and her testimony to the other various service providers, such as her most recent one in Duluth, is that she did admit that she's lied about her traumas in the past and she'll lie about them in the future. As to what she meant, we don't know. We do know that she has accused other people of sexual molestation. So it goes into the whole issue as to the reliability of child one and what she says here. And especially even going into further, even her own therapist said, well, she has PTSD, her memory probably isn't reliable. So again, you go into treating child one or treating my client as if he molested him and going through that, that's fine. But it does also change, it doesn't change the fact that he was never convicted, always denied it. And if that was a concern, there are a lot of concerns that could have been addressed or they could have done that to help facilitate visitation or something like that, which they never did, particularly with my client and child three, or even when my client left the state because he knew they would never allow him access or he knew he would impede mom's ability to get kids back, that they still used him as an excuse regarding mom. And so I think really in this case, what is really clear is from the beginning, Chippewa County Family Services knew they wanted to terminate parental rights and really actively worked that way towards that throughout the entire case, Your Honor. And with that, I'll see you the rest of my time to Mr. Kluver.
Thank you. Mr. Kluver, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case, as the guardian ad litem had said in this case, and the county agreed, the mother had checked all the boxes in this case, which means she completed everything they wanted her to complete successfully. She had been through inpatient treatment. She successfully completed that. She was subject to random testing throughout the CHIPS. She was successful in that. The only slip up was just before, under the stress of the termination, she had a slip. The law is clear in the case cited in my brief. We don't just terminate because there was a slip. That's a compliance issue that isn't a progress issue. But I wanted to address the best interest because I think the court finding really failed in the best interest of the children, when the court made a finding that there were no interests of the children that were in competition with the termination of the mother's parental rights. I don't know how a finding like that could be more erroneous. The children have an interest in maintaining their mother-child relationship. The guardian ad litem testified that the children want to go back home and live with the mother. Although, and this goes to my point, that although back the year prior, they maybe didn't want to at that time, at the time of trial, the latest information we have was that the kids did want to go home with their mother. And also, going home with their mother is the only way to keep these kids together. There's no planning for these children. There's no foster care available that can keep the children. The only way these children can stay together is to stay with their mother. Finally, not allowing these children back, according to the guardian ad litem, traumatizes these children, and we should avoid traumatizing further. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you all for your arguments in this case. We will take the case under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory period. Thank you.